This is Red Ice Radio. From the dream to reality. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome, friends. This is Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and we are delighted that you've tuned in to our program as we continue to detail and discuss what we consider to be some of the most important and interesting topics. RedIceCreations.com is the website. Go there for much more to follow us on a regular basis. Kevin Annett is a Canadian writer and former minister of the United Church of Canada. He has authored two books about Canadian Aboriginals, Love and Death in the Valley and Hidden from History, the Canadian Holocaust. In 2006, Kevin produced a documentary on this topic called Unrepentant. Kevin is back with us today on the program for an update to discuss the worldwide system of abuse by church and state on children and adults across the world. We'll talk about the tribunal he's involved in, his recent trip to England, and consequent arrest there. We'll also talk about canon law, the Roman Catholic system at the heart of this matter, child trafficking, and much more. Hiddenfromhistory.org, hiddennolonger.com, and itccs.org. are the websites. Well, Kevin, it's great to have you back once again with us. It's been quite a bit of time has passed, of course, since we last talked with you about the crimes in Canada. You have been continuing your fight. You've been keeping up the great work, Kevin. You've expanded the issues that you raise, and you've moved over to focusing more than Canada, just obviously more over in Europe as well, Kevin. And today, obviously, we're going to talk about some of the latest activities. But first of all, welcome back, Kevin. How are you today?
Thank you, Hendrik. It's great to be back with all of you. I'm doing fine.
Excellent. So tell us, give us a little bit of an update, Kevin. You've been over in the UK now. You have things coming up with the tribunal over here. What's going on, Kevin?
Well, there's so much going on. You know, generally what's happened is the crimes that we discovered in Canada involving murdered Indian children, we have found that this is a pattern all over the world. And in fact, since I was last on your program, I've been to Rome a number of times holding memorial services outside the Vatican, linking up with groups all over Europe who suffered the same kinds of crimes at the hands of not just the Roman Catholic Church, but churches and governments around the world. So a couple of years ago, we formed a new tribunal called the International Tribunal on the Crimes of Church and State, and we're uniting survivors of these crimes in at least five countries now, in Ireland and England, United States, Canada, and Australia. And we are convening a tribunal in the fall in London and Brussels to look at all this evidence and actually to try to get courts around the world to start to indict these church bodies for the crimes against children, not just the ones that have been in the news about their rape and torture, but actual evidence of mass murder, sterilization programs, and things that really amount to genocide all over the world. So it's really been heartening to the extent to which more and more people are coming forward with this evidence.
Absolutely. It seems that this, at the moment, then, Kevin, at least, goes under the banner of focusing on the Commonwealth countries. Is that correct? Is that a goal, and is that because of legal reasons as well?
Well, what we found, the common denominators here are the Crown of England and the Vatican. These are, in Canada, these are the two main institutions that authorize the residential schools and are really responsible for the death of over 50,000 children in these schools. In that, one of the places we're actually excavating in Canada is a mass grave near the first residential school in Brantford, Ontario, that was set up by the Church of England. And we found evidence that there's hundreds of children buried in the site. As a matter of fact, this coming month we're going to be doing forensic studies of those sites. And we've already issued a summons against the Queen of England and the Pope to answer these charges, to explain what happened to these children. And the fact that they aren't answering and are actually doing their best to try to avoid this is, I think, evidence that we're coming much closer to what happened in these schools.
It's an incredible story. It's horrendous when you begin to look into it and the crimes that has been committed. And you know, as your website, you know, alludes to, hidden from history, this has been going on for a long time in history, of course. And we're looking back not that far. We're talking about, you know, basically back from when the church started to move in and get established, if you will, in some of these countries. But give us just a brief backstory, a little bit on that, Kevin, for people who might not be aware of what you've been researching throughout the years.
Well, for me, it began when I was a clergyman in the early to mid-1990s on the west coast of Canada. I began to find firsthand evidence that a lot of the children had died in these Indian boarding schools that were set up by the government of Canada, the Crown and of England, and the Vatican. But after I was fired from the church for, you know, probing into these things, I began to uncover documentary evidence in universities across Canada, showing, for example, that the children were being deliberately housed, the sick with the healthy, and exposed to tuberculosis and then left to die en masse without receiving any medical treatment. This was standard procedure in many of the Indian boarding schools across Canada and the United States. Well, you know, in the press in Canada still, they refer to these deaths as accidental, as not happening because of a plan, when in fact all of the documentation and the eyewitnesses described that this was deliberate policy by the government to do this. And this carried on right to the 1990s in Canada. So what we see is that pattern of church and government deliberately colluding to seize the land of native people, to wipe out the young generation and destroy the family system. And what you find all over the world is this is how indigenous people are treated by any occupying power, by any colonial system that's trying to get their land. And that's why we feel that we've had to link up with groups around the world, because, you know, frankly, we're dealing with huge international institutions like the Catholic Church, governments. The United Nations has refused to investigate these crimes, even though, for example, they made involuntary sterilization a crime against humanity after World War II. These sterilizations were going on in Canadian hospitals right up until the 1980s, and probably since then as well, and not a peep from the international community. So we're talking about, you know, collusion at many levels, and in the way that these institutions are have international support and funding, the survivors themselves too have to be united across borders, and that's really what we're trying to do right now.
There, since we last talked with you, Kevin, there's been so much obviously unfolding when it comes to the Catholic, you know, sex abuse cases from mm-hmm. around the world. When you see this unfolding in the media, and when finally now some focus has been given to this issue, do you feel that it, you know, to a certain extent, justice is beginning to work here, or what's your view on this that has been unfolding lately?
Well, you know, Hendrik, I think the potential for justice is existing more, primarily because the news is out there and people feel encouraged to come forward and speak. You know, when you've been violated as a child, you live in a state of fear your whole life, and you can only speak about these crimes when it's safe to do so and when other people are saying, yes, we know you did suffer. That fact alone is allowing change to happen. But on the other hand, what's happening with equal intensity is the government and church is responsible, are doing their best to sideline and minimize these crimes. And they do it in a common way. They've done this in Canada. They're doing it now in Ireland and anywhere where these crimes are exposed. And simply what they do, the government and the churches get together and legally indemnify themselves. And that means they bring out an agreement that says, all right, we will acknowledge certain things. We will give a certain amount of money, but only if we are spared any legal consequence. And so in order to get money and recognition, survivors have to sign away the right to sue the churches. And in effect, what they're saying is the churches didn't do anything wrong. We don't hold them liable for anything. This is the agreement that happened. It was called the Ryan Report in Ireland. The Canadian government has this thing they call a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but it has no power to lay criminal charges. People aren't even allowed to name names of the wrongdoers in this investigation. So it's an enormous whitewash, and it's designed for, you know, two reasons: to protect the perpetrators because they're still in power, and to silence the witnesses and put out a false version of what really happened in these death camps, you know, that they called schools and orphanages. So that's generally what's going on, and so it makes it all the more important for the real truth to be exposed, you know, and this is what we keep trying to do all the time.
I had no idea. That's just incredible. They are basically, what you're saying is that they're in effect paying people off to keep quiet, basically.
Oh yeah, I've been to many of these hearings they hold across Canada. Native people who suffered are forced to recount in detail all the terrible things that happened to them. The church lawyers get to attack them and try to break them down so that they will give up their lawsuit. And the government stands by and allows this to happen. It's really colluding in re-traumatizing people deliberately. And when I've gathered with people in Ireland, I've held rallies outside the Irish Parliament. really in many places in Europe. But the Irish survivors told me that they're treated exactly the same way by the government in Ireland. It's the ones who've been harmed who are treated like criminals, and the criminals get to determine, you know, the terms of their compensation and justice. So it's really horrible, you know, what goes on.
Why is this happening? Why are they doing this, Kevin?
Well, I believe they're doing it because what we've uncovered is only the tip of the iceberg, that there's, in fact, many ongoing crimes that they don't want coming out. Because if these things were simply in the past, they could admit them, they could, and then, you know, move on. But they continue to hide these things because it's part of an ongoing genocide. To give you an example of that, there's a couple of things that are pretty obvious now. When we go to the doctors of Native people who suffered in these residential schools and try to find their medical records, they will not give them their own medical records because they're part of an ongoing series of experiments. In Canada, Native people are not allowed to refuse medical treatment because they're not citizens. They're wards of the state. And under the Indian Act, they can be given any amount of medication and they can't legally resist that. That's if they're living on reservations. So, for example, when the swine flu vaccine came out, they tested it on Native people on reservations. They went in there and just tested various drugs in that, and they do that continually. We know that a lot of the MKUltra experiments in the 1950s and 60s used Native people in Canada, you know, the various mind control experiments, because they were easy to get, and Native people could die and nobody would really care. And you find this any, you know, minority group anywhere in the world can be targeted and used in that way. And so these experiments are ongoing. Native people still sit on very valuable lands and resources. They're continually forcing them off their land. There's more oil in Canada than there is in Saudi Arabia. The Alberta tar sands is sitting on a bigger oil reserve than Saudi Arabia. And so that land is still occupied by the Cree people, and so there's a continual pressure to force those people off their land. The best way to do that is to traumatize them. And so, in other words, this war against indigenous people is continuing, and that's why the government can't come out and admit all these things, because it would implicate what they're doing still today to Native people.
Yeah, this is the crimes and the colonization that is happening after the armies have moved in. Our perspective, Kevin, if we look at you know, Canada, or actually European countries, then we have had churches here, you know, in northern countries and further down south of Europe as well, of course, battling with people for thousands of years back into history. But what we can see from the perspective of Canada and the United States is more recently. And I just wanted to ask what you think, what you see from your perspective when we look at something like Libya, for instance. We have the same arm of you know, military and governments from other parts of the world going in there now to claim, you know, the land, to take over the resources. But I mean, do you think that you can expect a similar scenario unfolding there against the children of Libya, consequently, and the eradication, the genocide against their people as well?
Well, that's very important that you mentioned that, because you found, for example, in Haiti, when there's any kind of natural disaster, child orphanages and adoption agencies move in, and a lot of children disappear in a disaster area. It's the same in a war. A lot of the people, the young children, simply disappear. And one of the reasons that is we know that, like drug and arms trafficking, child trafficking is a major underground industry in the world. It's very lucrative. We've actually, one of the things I do is I help document these child trafficking networks. We know that one of the major networks is all across the Pacific Rim, where in Thailand and at Canada, there's a direct kind of link between the way Native people there are disappearing regularly into these child trafficking networks and never seen again. So in a place like Libya, yes, absolutely, the children, they're fair game in a time of war under the cover of, you know, quote, democratizing the country, which, you know, in the case of Libya, it was really to get them off the gold dinar and back into the currency system. It's all about oil and economics, but the way you destroy a people's ability to fight back is to take away their children and destroy their family system. We see that all over the world.
We indeed do. It's horrendous. And I continuously go back to that idea, Kevin, of you know, why it is being allowed, and also who the people are at the top of this thing. What kind of, I mean, we still somewhere you have this idea that church is representing some kind of moral, you know, standpoint here in society. But it, I mean, it doesn't apply. What is this organization, Kevin? What is it that it represents?
Well, you know, I have kind of this a couple of levels on which you can answer that. Most immediately, it's clear that the church, and you know, we're talking the Roman Catholic Church and all its derivatives, the Protestant cousins, if you like. It's really the oldest and largest corporation in the world. It's not a religious body so much as a political organization, and the, one of the largest financial institutions in the world, the Vatican Bank. People don't realize, or maybe they do, but it's not a common fact, well-known fact, that the Vatican Bank cannot be monitored. It cannot be audited legally. You cannot know what it does, or even its board of directors. And it launders an amazing amount of money every year. You know, and the Vatican takes in at least $50 billion just from donations. And there's, with 73 countries in the world, and I'm pretty sure that includes the Scandinavian countries, although you'd have to look into that, there's special financial, what they call concordats with the Vatican, where governments take tax money, and in some cases, like in Germany, it's as much as 5% of the national revenue. And in Spain alone, they gave the Vatican 260 million euros last year alone. They rake all this money out of the different governments around the world, and they never account for any of this. So, I mean, it's a huge money operation that siphons a lot of money, and it owns one of the largest real estate operations in the world because it owns this land that's stolen from people all over the world. So, you know, when you're talking about the church, you know, you can't view it as is often portrayed as this, you know, religious body. It's quite the opposite in practice.
Absolutely. You're 100% right about that. I don't know how much land that the Swedish church owns up here, but it's quite a bit. They're the largest real estate owner, and they have so much mm-hmm. money. Yet at the same time, Kevin, when I read some of these cases, there was something about the Jesuits, I think, in Oregon. Maybe that's over a year ago now. I can't recall, but they claimed that they had to pay out lots of sums of money to some of the people and kids that they've molested and so forth as well. But they said this will basically bankrupt the branch and et cetera. And I couldn't help to think,
no.
Wait a minute, they have so much money, right, Kevin?
Well, as a matter of fact, I know that case because I worked with the Tamaki law firm that won that case against the Jesuits because I was working with some of the survivors in that case in America. And what happened with that case is it was $166 million, the largest settlement, but about 60% of that money didn't even come from the Jesuits. It came from their insurance companies. And the rest of the money didn't even come from the main Jesuit body, but it had been raised by a special collection that the Catholic Church had done over the world. So, I mean, the church isn't suffering at all. And when it makes that argument that it's going bankrupt, it's a way to get public sympathy for itself. They did the same thing in Canada. And by making that that lie, that declaration that they were going bankrupt, it then gave the Canadian government the right to say, okay, then we're going to step in and carry the financial burden of the churches so that now when Native people in Canada are compensated, the money is coming from taxpayers. It's not even coming from the churches, you know, because of this false cry that they're going bankrupt. So, I mean, you know, beneath the surface, they're not suffering at all. The only thing they ever have to do after having killed and tortured and raped children is they pay a bit of money and issue an apology and they're off the hook. Well, what killer in the world could ever do that? You know, these churches are getting away with what serial killers couldn't get away with.
Yeah, they are above the law. But at the same time, as you pointed out, Kevin, it seems like they have managed also to kind of write the laws in such a manner that they're not accountable for their actions, right? This is a legal
That's
issue
right.
at the bottom of it.
Well, it's because they operate, and this is a very old reason for this, of course. It goes back 1,000 years in England and other places. But under a system of canon law, the church has always said that we are a state unto ourselves. We are not operating according to the legal systems of any particular country. And that's why priests are literally absolved from any legal consequence for raping children. So what the reason the present Pope, Joseph Ratzinger, is in trouble is because he helped formulate a document called Crimen Solicitanus back in 1962, and he actually enforced this document when he was a cardinal in Munich. And what it says is when children are raped in the Catholic Church, what happened to them is not a crime, it's simply a sin. And a sin, of course, can be absolved. What a crime is talking about it. And so they imposed what they call the pontifical secret when a child is raped. That means if you're a priest or a bishop and you talk about what happened to that child, you can be excommunicated. You have to collude in concealing that crime. So in effect, every priest in the world is involved in a criminal conspiracy because they know that if a child is harmed, they're just keep quiet about it and not tell the police. You know, I mean, that's an enormous criminal conspiracy that shows that the church is, up till now, above the law because governments will not impinge on that autonomy they have.
I hear sometimes, Kevin, that the church or they're losing power across the world. Less and less people are going to the church on Sundays, etc. It's almost like we're led to believe that it's an organization that kind of slowly is just dying off. And I always thought, but wait a minute, at the same time, this is, as you pointed out, still one of the strongest organizations in the world because of their assets in resources and land and money. What is happening with the church right now, do you think, Kevin?
Well, I think both are true. I think on the ground, a lot of people are more and more leaving the church. As a matter of fact, in last year alone, more people left the Catholic Church in Germany than in its entire history. 30,000 people or more in 1 year alone announced that they were no longer Catholics. On the other hand, the institutional power of the church is so strong because it has that close relationship with governments and multinational corporations all over the world. One example of that is I was talking to a lawyer, Jonathan Levy, in America, who's tried to sue the Pope personally and serve papers on him. And he says the Vatican knows very quickly what anyone ever does against it because of its close connections with the CIA. Because ever since World War II, when the Vatican operated, the so-called rat lines where they got Nazis out of Europe,
right,
they had a close relationship with the CIA. And in the 1980s, Pope John Paul II got America to, for the first time, to diplomatically recognize it because they were closely involved with the opposition movement in Poland, the Solidarity movement there, which was heavily funded by the Vatican and the CIA. And that ever since then, there's been a very close connection, and they have that kind of power to undermine things that are brought against them.
The Vatican, the Jesuits, the Knights of Malta. Would you say, Kevin, as far as you're concerned, that these are organizations that are at the pinnacle, the top of the so-called pyramid of those who are attempting to control the planet and the globe, Kevin?
I think there's a lot of interconnections between the elites, and that's certainly one of them. There's another level on which to approach this, and that's, on a spiritual level, I think very much, if you want to call the force of destruction in the world, the Antichrist, it's certainly embodied in these institutions. No group that did the crimes it has done over the centuries and gotten away with it couldn't in any way be equated with the Spirit of Christ and Jesus' teachings. I mean, this is something exactly the opposite. And I think when you look at the way these elites operate, they have absolute contempt for humanity and human beings. As a minister working in Vancouver, I remember a radio commentator telling me, and he knew a number of the senior judges in town, he said, these people pass little children around that like they do a good bottle of wine. They have no humanity, and they think the entire human race is cattle for their use. So I think definitely there's something beneath the surface here that we need to look at about how, these elites definitely view us as a herd to be managed and used in any way they like, and that can only happen when we're unaware of their real nature and cooperate with their systems. And I think the more that we don't do that, the less power they have over us.
It's horrendous when you think about it, and it's beyond my grasp of understanding. If I'm going to be totally honest, it's something I can hear it, and I can I hear what you're saying, and I believe it, in that sense. But it's something that's very, very difficult to comprehend, and why the humanity has left these people. Is it something with the fact that this happens, do you think, when people enter into an organization like this, that they're slowly convinced or brought into it? Or how are they sucked into this, do you think, Kevin?
Well, I think there's a few things at work. And one of them is, and I find the difficulty of working publicly around the whole issue of child abuse and child trafficking is so many children in our kind of in the European tradition of child rearing, so many of us are traumatized and violated at a young age. It may not be sexually or physically, but there's an emotional violation that goes on, where children are told at a very young age, you're not allowed to trust your own feelings and your thoughts. You have to think the way we want you to. You cannot feel that. You cannot have a normal reaction to something. You've got to be managed and controlled. Now, that kind of trauma, as long as we keep that inside and can't name it, we are oppressed. We cannot speak out against injustices done to people because of that fear we all carry inside. Now, I've seen, you know, that system that we live under seems to be set up to deliberately traumatize and dissociate people at a young age so that they're just cogs in a wheel. They can fit into the labor market and pay their taxes and not object to what's going on to them or to the planet. And I think that's deliberate. In that sense, we're all victims of the system. It isn't just Native children or children in Ireland or something. It's a universal system. So I think that's part of the deeper thing we're dealing with.
In September now, you're going back to the UK. Remind me if this is right or not, but in last time you were there then in May, I think that on May the 29th, you were jailed and you're eventually deported from London, right?
Yeah.
Tell us about that, Kevin.
Well, that followed after some real successes we had in Europe. And just to give you a little bit of background before I talk about that, in the previous year, we had met, the delegation of us had gone to Rome. We had met with a number of Italian politicians in the Chamber of Deputies there. These senators had promised us support for our work. We were on European television, had a huge press conference in Rome where we described the genocide in Indian residential schools. We had all offers all over Europe for interviews and support. And in the wake of that, what happened was I was invited to Trafalgar Square to speak at a rally against child abuse. And that rally was describing the involvement of the government in fairly high-level pedophile networks in England. Before, I had gone to the Netherlands at the end of May to speak, and on my way back into London, I was stopped at Stansted Airport, told that I wasn't allowed back into the country. They gave me no reason except, well, they felt it strange that a Canadian citizen would be giving public lectures in England, which is like no reason whatsoever.
Right.
And on that, they simply barred me from the country. They kept me in an immigration prison for 12 hours, and that was it. I was just barred from England. So I don't think it's unrelated to the rally I was going to be speaking at or the fact that we recently aired evidence that the Queen of England herself had been seen in the company of 10 children at a residential school who had then disappeared and were never seen again. And we wrote to the Queen and asked her to respond to that, and of course she never has. But this is the kind of evidence that's implicating people fairly high up in their system. And so
oh, yeah.
I think that's why one of the reasons they certainly don't want me there.
Obviously, a means of protecting yourself is to be making public engagements, talking about this, being as open as possible, right? This is a way to kind of combat this, if you will, because you become, in one sense, untouchable because the more you speak about this openly, right, Kevin?
Well, that's right. The only defense you really have is public exposure. And, the other side knows that. They know that their main weapon, like I often say to people, if I was a Native man, I'd be dead by now. But the fact that I'm white and a clergyman gave me more protection. And so what they do then, their main weapon against people who are kind of in the establishment and speak out, they just try to discredit them and say they're crazy, they can't be trusted. And they've done their utmost to try to do that and to try to isolate me and the evidence that I brought out. But what's fortunate now is that this evidence is so widely acknowledged now that they can't deny it anymore. And everything basically that I've been saying is being confirmed. I mean, the government of Canada had to come out 2 years ago and acknowledge that half these children died in the residential schools. So at that point, the lid is off and they can't really keep it a secret anymore.
And all they have at the end of the day is violence. That's the only thing they could do. They could bar you from speaking, or they can do anything they want, from their point of view, attempt to try to prevent this from coming out, of course. But at the end of the day, I always go back to that idea that the only reason they've ended up in the position they have throughout the hundreds and if not thousands of years of battling with humanity, it's been because of violence, right? That's all they have, really.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's ultimately their. When they get to the point of doing that, it shows you how bankrupt they are.
Yes.
Because more and more people are waking up. I see this all over the world wherever I go. there's people all over the place who are awoken to this now and saying, well, I don't feel like I have a loyalty to the system anymore. We have to reclaim our natural rights, defend our children, defend our planet, and the system is not doing that. In fact, it's doing the opposite. The courts are not defending our children. They're colluding in them. The churches are betraying the trust they were given. So why support these institutions anymore? Let's walk away from them. And I see that all over.
Absolutely. It's really encouraging in that way. And that brings us back to this question again of what you're involved in currently with the tribunal, because the question for me has always been, is there a way to battle against them in a legal way? Because if they've set up the system, if they control it, if they set the laws and the rules, what have you, is there any way they can be reached through legal means being in their system, Kevin?
Well, not within their jurisdiction. That's something that I often go through with Native people who try to go to white courts and sue the churches. I say, well, look, the courts in Canada, like every member of parliament, take a personal oath of allegiance to the crown. Not to the people of Canada, only to the crown. So I say they're foreign agents. You can't rely on them to indict their paymasters. What we need is what common law grants to everybody, and that is the right, when the institutions and the courts are not defending you, you have the right to establish your own courts, your own community policing, and to protect your natural rights that no one can take away from you. So what we've done, for example, on the west coast of Canada, among the Squamish people, some of the indigenous elders are now setting up their own tribal courts in the Longhouse, where they've said, we don't trust the European court system. We've issued eviction orders on these churches to get off our land. Now we're going to enforce them. And that's the kind of grassroots alternatives that people need to create just to defend their children, just to say, you know, we not only don't trust the police and courts, we know in practice that they're our enemies, that they're working, you know, for these elites and who are not protecting us or the planet. So this is what people had to learn through bitter experience.
Yeah, because it seems like to me, if we begin to approach this, we want to approach the UN, let's say, to try to get recognition for this, that, or the other. The UN is a recent organization. It seems to be based out of the same legal premises, and at the end of the day, that still boils down to individual nations and the Commonwealth countries and the legal system to be involved in one way or another. So it has to be a previous law system or a bypassing happening, because again, as I go back and research Swedish history, for instance, Kevin, then this, I think this is true across the board in most countries, there always have been an indigenous people there in some way or another. Mm-hmm. And this has always been supplanted by those who came in later, the church in many cases than in most countries, set up their system, set up their rules and their laws, and they basically come in there again with violence and say, you don't have any jurisdiction here. We control everything now, and because you previously as a people don't have anything written up or anything like that, you can't claim anything over us. But there must be a way to bypass that, right?
Well, there is. And, you know, one of the most basic ways is to say, well, where does that all come from? It really comes from a system that started with the Romans. And whenever the Romans would invade an area, they had this thing called res nullius in Latin, which means no one's object. It objectified and nullified the rights of any people there and reduced them to the state of objects. So they said, in other words, through the various papal bulls, they said all of the pagans around the world, the people who are not Catholic Christians, do not have any legal standing. They're not human beings until they become baptized Catholics. And as short of that, we have the right to their land and everything else about them. So whether it happens in Sweden or Canada or anywhere in the world, it's the same assumption that law exists to protect these elites, and nobody else has any inherent rights whatsoever. Just, you know, so it's a system of slavery, and we have to, you know, recognize that and name it for what it is.
Absolutely. And of course it's discouraging when we think about the fact that they are the people, or they represent something now which has control of all the weaponry and the military and the armies around the world. How do we combat that, though? Because we can't get together and with our pitchfork and shovels here, Kevin. Mm-hmm.
Well, look what's happened in places like Egypt, and that you notice that people have amazing power among themselves once they discover it, and the armies tend to go over. Our strongest weapon is reason and common sense and love. and we keep making that appeal to people and reach hearts and minds. And in a real crisis, the army will go over to people once they can be reached. I mean, that's been proven time and again in history. And so I think we just have to keep taking the higher ground all the time and appeal to soldiers and police and everybody. Look, you have families. We're talking about three basic things: protecting our earth, protecting our children, and protecting our natural rights as citizens. And we're not going to surrender any of those three, and nor our liberties. And the problem with relying on the court system is, even at the level of the United Nations, individuals can be prosecuted for genocide, but states cannot be. So a regime can never be tried for the crime it did, only individuals. But we're talking about regimes that are guilty historically of these crimes. So that proves that we need a whole new legal system, and that's in fact what they created in Nuremberg. And you know, we need to do that again, and that's part of the philosophy behind our tribunal. We need to encourage people to start doing that in their own communities.
Give us an example then of what you're doing with your tribunal and what's going to happen over in England now in September, do you think, when you go back there, Kevin?
Well, I'm actually starting in Brussels, and the reason we chose that is because we've had support in the European Parliament there for a motion to have Canada investigated for genocide. So on September 15th, there's going to be gatherings that begin in Brussels, in London, hopefully in Rome, and certainly all over North America, where people are going to announce this tribunal. They're going to start the investigations and the proceedings. And for about 3 months until Christmas, we're going to be gathering this evidence. The ultimate objective is to bring it together into a final report and create a documentary film and get this out all over the world to say, look, here's the evidence of church and state collusion in these crimes, and here's the next step. We need to bring legal sanctions and other kinds of sanctions against these criminal bodies. We're working with two lawyers in Germany who are trying to sue the Pope as a German citizen because of his collusion in hiding the abuse of children in the mm-hmm. Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, all of these things are like parts of streams coming together into a big river. And, we're liaisoning with people all over the world, but we're really saying you have to take action in your own community. That's what gives us power.
Are you seeking now for people to get involved in this as well, beginning in September, stretching out to December, as you mentioned? And if so, Kevin, where can people go to find out more about this or meet up, I guess, with people who are already, a part of this?
Well, we're revising our website, itccs.org, and people can read updates there. But what I would recommend for people in Scandinavia and elsewhere who are listening to this is, I will be traveling extensively during October, especially in England. I've been in Copenhagen a number of times. I hope to come up to Scandinavia and sit down and work with people. But if they can contact me, my email is kevin_annett@hotmail.com. And what we need is the ability to kind of sit down and work out in your own area. What are the issues? What are the things that people can work on together? One of the things that I'm also doing is at the end of October, if people can get down to Rome, there's actually a gathering on October 30th to 31st of groups from all over the world who have suffered at the hands of the Catholic Church, and they're going to be holding an event where they want to try to surround the entire Vatican and hold a vigil there, a prayer vigil, and a public memorial there for the children who died. So these are the kinds of events that we're going to post on our site, and hopefully there'll be more of those as more people get involved.
So basically, this is just a means to help to bring attention to this, to the point where media and hopefully others cannot ignore the situation anymore, correct?
That's right. And the more people, survivors who speak, we find the more that happens. In Ireland, for example, every week there have been groups of people standing outside the Dáil, which is the Irish Parliament. And as a result of that kind of pressure, the Irish president, Kenny, announced last month that they were changing the laws in Ireland so that now when a priest does not report child abuse, he can go to jail for 5 years, even if it's told to him in the confessional. And that's an amazingly radical thing for the Irish to be doing in a traditionally very conservative Catholic country, to say that the church cannot hide the truth anymore, even in the confessional, that they are subject to the law. That move by Kenny couldn't have happened unless there was all these protests happening. At one point, there was over 5,000 people protesting outside his office in Dublin. And it's that kind of public protest outside churches. We've even held rallies inside churches during the Mass, where we go in and speak to the people in the pews. and say, stop giving money to these churches when they're harming children. That's the kind of thing that really gets media interest and forces governments in some way to respond.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any difference, do you think, Kevin, between we primarily have Catholic Church at the center here, but Protestants, Anglican, Lutheran, Baptist, on any of the denominations, or is it pretty much the same procedure across the board? What's your take on that, Kevin?
Do you mean are these churches, other churches involved in the same kinds of crimes and everything?
That's right, yes.
Yeah, that's what I found. In Canada and other countries, the Protestant churches were just as deeply involved in running these boarding schools. The death rate was just as high in Protestant schools. Now, the Roman Catholic Church set up the original model for these boarding schools, and they're clearly the biggest perpetrator. But the Protestant churches tended to have the same attitude, that people who weren't Christian didn't have the same rights, didn't have the same humanity, if you like. So, I mean, I think it's kind of a sickness that comes out of European Christianity as a whole, not just Catholicism. But definitely when you're looking for example, the endorsement of sterilization programs, you often had churches endorsing them because they believed that certain groups like the mentally deficient and others didn't have the right to have children. So, I mean, you often had that attitude in all the churches.
Do you think that the suggestion or the solution to many of these problems as well is for people to simply go out of the church if they've, in this country, for instance, I think everybody is born into the church, so to speak. You have to make an active decision later in your life to actually, you know, write yourself out of it, basically. But a solution, turning their backs on the organization, making sure that there's no money reaching them, or what do you see as parts of solution here, Kevin?
Well, I think definitely people can take that individual action and need to. I mean, you can be a Christian without attending these churches. That's how Christianity began, in small little groups of people meeting in their homes. People should go back to that, and that way they don't have to be affiliated with these corporations that are acting in their name and causing all these crimes. But on a broader scale, there needs to be changes in the laws of society where there's a real separation of church and state, where no public money goes to support any particular religion, where priests do not have the right to stand above the law. For example, priests should be made public servants, like teachers or social workers, and given licenses. And if they harm a child, those licenses can be revoked. Those kind of structural changes, I think, are needed, as well as the individual, you know, acts of conscience.
Absolutely. And of course, Kevin, this is not restricted by any way to the churches. As you say, you bring part of the state into this as well. We're talking about governments being participatory in this as well. I remember the case over in Scotland that still is ongoing, of course, but with Holly Grieg, we had her mother and their representative or spokesperson, Robert Green, with us here on the program over a year ago now, and talked about that case, which shows that this is a kind of the same procedure ongoing in government and among politicians as well, correct?
Oh, absolutely. You find that child trafficking rampant throughout the system. And we know I know the Holly Grieg case. In fact, I spoke at a conference in England and met Robert and Holly Grieg and her mother. And they're wonderful people, very brave, determined people. And what they were telling me sounds exactly like the things we discover all the time in Canada, where social workers and politicians actually use the government system of child welfare to find children, for child trafficking and pedophile purposes. And so, you know, it's not confined to any one country. It's like an international network, really.
Absolutely. I think that was brought out by the Dutroux case a few years ago in Belgium, showing at least parts of these rings. And we get it trickles down a little bit now and then, Kevin. I mean, a while back now I heard from a child actor, I forget his name right now, but he talked about pedophilia being rampant in Hollywood among directors and people there, right? So it doesn't matter what kind of part it is. It seems to be all over the human society. It's a tremendous disease, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's that's why I said earlier, when we start talking about child abuse, it's hitting a raw nerve for a lot of people, because it's rampant, and in many ways it happened to a lot of us. And so it's hard when you haven't faced your own child trauma and feeling of helplessness. It's hard to become a fully competent, you know, conscious person, because we're living in very much in a state of fear. And it's overcoming that fear that, you know, I found the way I was able to continue in this work working in the healing circles with Aboriginal survivors, you learn skills there about how to face your own demons in order to how to be there for other people. And I think that's really an important part of the work where we have to do.
Absolutely. I mean, what you do is fantastic, bringing attention and, especially having the guts, to do that and to bring this topic to the surface. Are you hopeful about the future, Kevin? Do you feel positive? You're surfing a wave of encouraged positive energy right now. Or how's your sense about the future, Kevin?
Well, I'm always hopeful just because of the hope given to me all the time working with people on the ground. You have to always stay close to the ground, close to the people who you're serving and helping letting them speak. Because once people find their voice, tremendous things happen. And the whole system that we think is so solid, the system of oppression, begins shaking in a serious way. The fact that we're bringing more and more of this to attention means the attacks have certainly increased on the work we're doing. A number of the Native men I worked with over the last 2 years have actually been killed by the Vancouver police. One man died recently in a hospital. Clearly, he was murdered there. These were eyewitnesses to crimes, in the residential schools, including that incident that I mentioned about the Queen, where she apparently abducted 10 Native children who were never seen again back in 1964. And so, the repercussions become more severe, but so do the number of people coming forward. And so, I mean, it's a constant, recognition that we are making change happen, but there's always a risk. And that's why more and more of us need to speak out so that risk isn't as bad.
You're keeping track of this event. Obviously, everyone that's involved in this remember these kinds of things, these kinds of stories. That means that also the more violence they give back, so to speak, this is something that accumulates and just adds to your case in a way, right?
Yeah, well, exactly, and it proves what we're saying. The key tool we have to use is learning to be our own media, be our own spokespeople, not relying on some national newspaper to cover this thing when, the media is largely corporate controlled now and can be turned on and off very simply.
Yeah.
Coming on your show and shows like this, this is the way that the voices are heard. This is the only way our movement has survived, is because of alternative media, people being that themselves. So that's something I've had to learn as well.
Absolutely. That's the only way to do it. Keep talking about it and reaching out to the people who are willing to listen. And I think, I believe that more and more people as well are beginning to awaken to these and other atrocities that are happening and have been happening around the world, and let's just detail a few of the websites here as well, Kevin, because we want to give people information on how to. This is just a brief update we're doing with you now, of course, and your work is continuing. You're involved in this all the time, but hiddenfromhistory.org, that's your main website. You have, for those who haven't seen it, by the way, an excellent documentary, I still believe, featured on the website as well, that people can take a look at for more background specifically on the Indigenous people in Canada, right? That's still up there, Kevin?
That's right. The film is Unrepentant, and it's actually being broadcast on German television last year to over 10 million people. And whenever I come to your country, I'll certainly bring that, and we can organize some film screenings of it.
Excellent. Then we have Hidden No Longer. Tell us about that website, Kevin.
HiddenNoLonger.com is actually my entire research. It's the updated version of my book, Hidden from History. And it was actually being destroyed and removed from libraries across Canada, so we realized it was important to post it on the internet. And there have been thousands of downloads of the book since then. It really has all the evidence we're talking about of genocide in Canada. And so it's www.hiddennolonger.com.
Excellent. And then finally, itccs.org. This is for the tribunal specifically, and for people to also get involved, I guess, Kevin?
That's right. It has news from around the world. It has kind of an outline of what the tribunal is doing, and updates, and really encouraging people to post their own news when they discover particular evidence, when they organize rallies or whatever. We try to keep it updated. So it's itccs.org.
We'll, of course, have all those of these links up on redicecreations.com as well, so people out there listening and who didn't have a pen or paper to click through from our website easily as well. But let's see if there's anything else that we want to mention, that we want to get out now, Kevin, before we wrap things up for this time, for this brief update from you. What do you think, Kevin?
I think generally, I just want to encourage people that, you know, I've been at this almost 20 years, and many times it looked like I was just in an impossible situation. But what really kept me going is staying close to people on the ground. And it's easy in this day and age to get caught up in the internet and thinking that it's the technology that keeps people together. And in one sense, it does. It's a tremendous tool. But I find that the way we sustain our hearts and minds is just being with one another. And that's why I often, when we hold gatherings and that, I hold it in a circle format whereby everyone can speak and talk about their own life and their situation to build up those long-term relationships, so we know we can trust one another. We know we're in this for the long haul. This is not going to change in 1 or 2 years. It's over a lifetime. We change and recover our lives and our liberties over many lifetimes, and so we need that long-term perspective. We know we're in this for the long haul, and we need one another. We're all we have, each other. You know, we don't have arms or money or anything, but we have each other, and that's what I really want to emphasize to people. So that's why I look forward to, you know, coming and meeting you, Hendrik, but also other people who want to work on this. I think that's the best way we build this movement.
Absolutely. And depending also then on where you'll be heading next and so forth, is the primary updates about this on itccs.org, or where will you post this kind of information, Kevin, when you're traveling around and so forth?
Well, by the end of the month, I'll be posting new information primarily on the itccs.org website. And the more recent news, probably the best thing for people to do is just to write me at my email, kevin_annett, A-N-N-E-T-T, at hotmail.com. And we can make those direct links and you know, set up meetings during the fall when I'm in Europe.
Okay, excellent. Keep up the great work, Kevin. You're very brave. My thanks to you, obviously, and to everyone working with you, shining a light on this disturbing issue. It's so important in trying to get the attention to this and breaking the cycle, I think, as well, of abuse that has been seemed to be just ongoing and rolling along. And the only thing that seems to be able to stop that cycle of abuse is to be able to shine a light on it and bring it to the surface, because I think the more we hide it, the more it will grow in the shadows, basically, if you will,
yeah.
Kevin. This is something that seems to lurk under the surface, and the more we try to cover up, the worse it gets, Kevin.
That's right. It's like a wound. It has to be brought into the air to heal, and it's a painful process, but it's got to be done. And I thank you for your witness and your courage in bringing all these stories out, Hendrik, and I do look forward to seeing you in the coming months.
You bet. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Thank you.
We have much more for you in the pipeline. Keep your browser tuned to redicecreations.com for more radio coming your way with Marsha Schaefer, Bob Dean, Judy Wood, Penny Pierce, John Coleman, Robert Bavall, Ken Thomas, Rosalind Peterson, Carl-Johan Kallemann, and Frank O'Collins. We'll be back with more before you know it. Take care in the meantime. Thank you for listening today.